From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Boy State, a new documentary from directors Jesse Moss and Amanda McBain, plunges the viewer into a sea of more than 1,000 rowdy Texas teenage boys, politics junkies who spend a week on an educational exercise, trying to devise a functioning government. Moss and McBain have made more intimate films in the past. They shot this one with a whole crew of cinematographers.
Because we'd been on fiction sets before, I did give everybody walkie-talkies. I have to tell you, I don't think anybody used them because no one had time.
The work paid off. Boy State was a hit at Sundance, setting a record for the biggest documentary buy ever at the festival at $12 million. We'll talk with Moss and McBain about the critical process of choosing their central characters, the year they spent editing their reams of footage, and the bidding war that landed their film with Apple and A24. But first on the News Banter, of course you realize this means war. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my buddy in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, the town has been in an uproar. This past week, a group of agents started out with four guys from CAA, but it turned out that they were part of a broader plan. They left CAA and they said they were starting a new management company. And there's been a lot of talk about how the agency business basically is not so great anymore for various reasons. For example, you know, it used to be if you pulled the brass ring and you got a show like Big Bang Theory and you went into syndication, you would get extraordinarily rich as a client and your agent would also participate in the wealth. And now you have everybody tilting towards streamers. You have an industry completely constricted because of the pandemic, lack of cash flow, lack of, you know, opportunity right now. You have a really difficult, challenging time for agents. And the idea was that it would be better to be a manager, that there's actually an opportunity to make more money as a manager. So the guys from CAA, this first group, was joined by men and women from WME, from UTA. And basically, even though in the initial hours, it was like, we're all going to be friends and it's going to be fine and we're all going to be chill, it very quickly became clear that this is kind of war. The new group, they call themselves Moxie in these materials designed for investors. They're saying that's not actually the name, but they sent out these materials and the materials are kind of like, you know, forget those old guys who don't care about you anymore. We are the ones who are agile and will take care of you. And these other guys are doing whatever. They're distracted. There are millions of other businesses. So we are the ones who know how to agent, but we can be your manager. And therefore, what do you need them for? It's pretty aggressive. And the big agencies are, if they can, if they still have the power, they're going to try to strangle this thing.
Yeah, this is like one of those many scenes in Entourage where Ari Gold throws his BlackBerry at the wall and says, I'm going to destroy you, because the agencies just are going to try to shut this thing down. And there's a couple things that are going on that are causing this. I think one is the demise of the traditional back end, which is causing rates and revenues to go down, which you mentioned. I think another is the leadership of these big agencies. You see at CAA and WME especially, they have taken private investment. They have taken hundreds of millions of dollars out of these companies. They have put them into new businesses like the UFC and IMG at WME and CAA going into production. And these moves have caused the Writers Guild to sue their agencies. And you're just seeing a level of dissatisfaction in the middle and upper middle level of agents. And I know, get out your violin, boo-hoo for the agents yeah. that make tons of money representing clients. But there is a sense that it's not like it used to be. And they see these managers who are held to less strict standards as to what they can and can't do, who are able to produce directly with their clients and have their names on these movies and shows as producers. They just see that as a more lucrative business, and they think that they can do it while not upending the entire ecosystem of representation. And that's the question, is whether they can.
Yeah, somebody pointed out to me that, you know, by the time Bron Meyer left CAA, Mike Ovitz left CAA when they were the Uber agents of Uber agents. They left in their 50s. Now you have the generation that was once called the Young Turks. That was at CAA. It was, you know, Richard Lovett, Kevin Huvane, people who are still in charge there, Brian Lord. That group is still there. And they're not in their 50s anymore. They're not young Turks now. We got to change that. And so the actual young Turks, the young, restless people in the, you know, somewhat younger, busy, good clients, they're like, well, you know, we're not getting ours. And it is partly, I think, the fault of these older guys, the display of wealth. And I include Ari Emanuel in this, you know, the display of actual, the art, the this, the that, the toys. Of course, these other agents, and again, tiny violins, but still they thought, well, that's going to come to me. And then between their business decisions, the risk and the pandemic and streaming, all of that, it's like, no, it's never going to come to you. So now they're mad.
And don't forget, you know, Ari specifically promised these guys that Endeavor would go public and they would become
absolutely
fantastically wealthy.
And the idea, I think, was if Endeavor pulled that off, the others probably follow. So, and that didn't happen, and they're waiting for their goodies. Let me just say, though, with this new company, one thing that is going to potentially cause them problems is that we don't know all the investors in this thing, but one that we do know is Steve Cohen. He's the CEO of a hedge fund. He had put in $25 million, we believe, for a 30% stake. He's also a prominent Trump supporter. He put $1 million into Trump's inauguration. His firm was sued for sexual harassment in 2018. In 2016, they were fined for SEC violations. This guy is extremely controversial. And already some people, like I will cite Julio Torres, who created those spookies for HBO, he tweeted, "Do the clients know?" He says, "Those profiting off woke artists think we'll be like, stop Trump, not realizing we make money for GOP showbiz daddies." So that kind of thing is something that I think the agencies will pick up to say, look who backs this new firm. You don't want to be associated with that. Whether that gets any traction is hard to tell.
Oh, they're already putting that out around town. And, you know, I think Steve Cohen, it's one thing to invest in a bunch of different places that where optics don't matter, but in Hollywood, optics do matter. And if you're a firm that represents people like Margot Robbie or Bradley Cooper, where some of these agents coming over have represented those people in the past, you know, that stuff matters because they're going to get asked about it in the press. Yeah. So I think that's one complication. The other is just the dynamic at work here. The management community in Hollywood is very different from the agents who are, you know, kill or be killed and poach whoever clients you can. The managers typically don't poach from each other. And now you've got these former agents coming in to be managers, and they're going to these management companies and saying, oh, well, we're just going to co-manage with you some of these clients that they really had as agents before. And the management companies are saying, wait a second, why would we do that? Why do we want to take on a co-manager? It is a different role and we do a different thing. And in the process, we're going to upset the big three talent agencies that we have business with and we refer clients back and forth with all the time. So I think you're going to see resistance from the management community in Hollywood, resistance from the agencies, and you may find that this new company is the odd man out around town.
You know, Mike Ovitz tried starting AMG, and he had left, and he started this management company, and CAA just said, we're not doing business with you, which was killer at that point. You couldn't survive with a CAA boycotting you. They are certainly holding out the possibility in their own ways that that could happen again with this company. So I think there's maybe some kind of talks, but whether they can work this thing out, we'll see. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Picture this: over 1,000 amped up high school boys from across the state of Texas crammed together for a chaotic week, figuring out how to elect their leaders and form a government.
I'm playing this like a game. I would like very much to win.
I love it, boys. I love it. Where are you from?
I come from a very modest family.
I'm on the course to be the first one to graduate from high school.
I'm a progressive person, and I'm in a room full of mostly conservative people.
Our masculinity shall not be infringed.
In their new Apple TV Plus film, Boys State, filmmakers Amanda McBain and Jesse Moss plunge the viewer into this annual event, part of a nationwide program sponsored by the American Legion. The idea is to teach high school juniors citizenship and leadership skills. And yes, there is also a Girl State. Participants are divided into made-up parties. They work out a platform, which puts them ahead of the GOP this year, and hold mock elections. Among the many former participants, Cory Booker, Dick Cheney, Bill Clinton, Rush Limbaugh, and Garth Brooks. Filmmakers Moss and McBain got interested in the subject when they read an article about the 2017 Texas Boys State stirring controversy by voting to secede from the union. Before they could pitch the movie to funders, they had to win the trust of the Texas Boys State organizers.
That conversation went on for a while, though, and they really, you know, wanted to see our past work. And the more that they told us about the program, though, and what had gone down in years past, the more interested, of course, we got in making the film.
So what we did, though, based on the positive response for Access from the program, we wrote a 4-page treatment for sort of imagining what the film could be. And I remember it opened with a quote from the New York Times about the threats to our democracy being very real. And we wanted our prospective funders to recognize that we thought there was a larger conversation to be had here with this.
I was wondering whether there wasn't distrust on the part of the people running this program that you would come in liberal documentarians who might ridicule what they were doing or ridicule the kids. Were they nervous about that?
Yes. I think, of course they were. I think it's definitely a leap of faith to ever let documentarians get into your life the degree that we need to. I think that that's what all those conversations were about, is really on trying to get to know us and our sensibility and what we wanted to do.
I mean, how did you win their trust? Was there a moment where you felt you had won their trust?
No, I mean, honestly, I really think the minute that I got on the phone with Paul Barker, who was the director of the program at the time, I recognized this is somebody who is comfortable with a little bit of that risk, but also smart enough and really deeply trusting enough of his own program to know that it's not about the program so much as, you know, trusting our commitment to accurately portraying the program, right?
The other thing is that they did their due diligence, though, and they looked at our past work, and I don't think you can put it in a box and categorize it as this, that, or the other thing. And I think based on that and Amanda's conversations with Paul, they invited us to come out and meet with them in Austin, which we did, and begin the casting process. And that's really only what we could do because Concordia stepped up to fund the development. And what that meant was we could spend a couple of months traveling around Texas and meet some of the boys who were either had been selected or were being selected for the program.
Not just some, like a lot.
You met lots, right? I've read about the exhaustive vetting of boys that you did. And I'll just pause to say how great it must have been to feel that you were financed for that, because that is quite the thing, you know? I mean, the relief of not having to be cobbling it together must have been enormous. Unless you did.
They hadn't committed to production financing, and we knew that that was going to be a big ticket because the only way to capture the event was to build a big team. And so the initial financing was only a small amount of money to do the travel around Texas and to put together a casting reel.
Yeah, so I mean, the odds were not necessarily in your favor. There are over 1,000 boys coming to this thing, and you vetted through and picked three, according to what I've read, and then the fourth one sort of picked himself at some point and thrust himself upon you. I mean, congratulations, you picked very well. I don't know how you managed to do that.
This is like one of those things that we're still trying to figure out, I think, the answer to. I'm not sure there is like one answer. I really think we got very lucky, but I think also we've been doing this for a while and kind of know maybe quicker than we used to what isn't interesting to us. Tons of these kids that we met were all very impressive. But then you meet enough people and you get to that place where you then come face to face with these three kids who we ended up picking in advance. And it was just instantly recognizable, like, oh, okay, here you are. You have the short list of things that we know we need, diversity of different political viewpoints, different backgrounds, all that. But you also have something else that we've been looking for that makes you sort of endlessly interesting to us and surprising.
That's charisma, vulnerability. Looking at people through the camera is really necessary too, because ultimately we're making a film, and how comfortable are you in front of that camera? And that was clear. Ben and Robert and Stephen were all kind of effortlessly themselves in ways that were fascinating to us. One challenge, though, is that we didn't really know what the event itself was going to look like or feel like, and we could not convey that in the casting reel. We could show Concordia studio some really exceptional young men who we liked, but that didn't convey what we were actually going to film once the program got started. So that was a huge X factor.
Yes, I guess I had to take a leap of faith on that one.
There was a lot of leaps of faith, I think, on everybody involved in this film. I mean, like everybody.
And they had about 2 weeks to say yes or no once we delivered the casting
reel.
They had a week.
My goodness. Did they seem to agonize, or was there a long wait for the scary phone call?
No. I think the casting reel we made actually was pretty excellent. I will say that.
Pretty damn good, if you say so yourself.
We already felt like, wow, this is going to be something special. I can't believe we, you know, again, because we immediately recognized these three kids were really interesting to us.
I look forward to vote. I know spoilers, but I do look forward for voting for one of them.
Me too.
For something. I won't say which one, but one of them.
I wouldn't follow that, make a film about them going to the grocery store, frankly. So like, I think we were already really excited. And that's even before the event got started.
That event, just watching the film is like, they're sort of constantly going places. And I read a quote, I think maybe it was you, Jesse, I'm not sure, you can tell me. You said at one point we had 7 cinematographers deployed through this vast event, trying to be at every place at one time. The scale of production was like a fiction film. It took a year to edit. Did you even know where they were going and why at certain points?
No. I mean, it's a wonderful way to make a movie, as terrifying as it is. And we'd never made a movie that way. And we had been on some fiction sets and had more people around us, more crew. But this is really unscripted. And some events were planned and on a schedule. But what would happen in them and which of our characters would take us there, that we didn't know. So it was a kind of unholy mashup of unscripted filmmaking, kind of scripted preparation. But that's a place that we were comfortable working, right? And is exciting.
Did they have walkie-talkies? Did you say you follow Ben and you follow this other guy, and they just go off into the wild and shoot? And I mean wild sometimes, because these are very high testosterone boys. Or did you have walkie-talkies and say, I'm going over to the thing now?
That's a great question. And because we'd been on fiction sets before, I did give everybody walkie-talkies. I have to tell you, I don't think anybody used them because no one had time. The control and chaos kind of combo, I mean, the choreography of what happened on the UT campus, which by the way is massive. That was also something I didn't quite know, is how spread out all these events were going to be over this massive university and, you know, 1,100, four main characters and like 1,100 support characters is really a thing. So we did use texts, right, to keep sort of in touch with one another. But really the way it worked was we appointed day one, we kind of talked through the three main characters that we had, well, four at that point, before we found Renee, and we assigned a cinematographer to each of those four people. And actually they traveled from those kids' homes to the event with them. They kind of barnacled to that person. Still, though, there were these moments of such pandemonium, like in the main quad at night, where the cinematographer would lose their character, right? And then we would sort of have this moment of like, where, and you know, on a fiction set, you would have 10 PAs, like, what's your 20? Like, we would just have to be running around this and trying to find the main character. So there were moments of total chaos. And you really just kind of have to hold on and keep pushing. And fortunately, we had this A team of very experienced, very poetic, very, you know, sensitive, but also hardworking, you know, Verite camera people who like did insanely long days and managed to stay focused as much as possible, because it was a trying environment.
Oh, I'm sure. I can't imagine how exhausting it must have been just trying to figure out what was going on and where your people were and what you wanted to shoot. I don't know if anybody would send you a note like, I just got a great one, so mark this part of the tape, or you just had to go into this masses of tape and figure out what you wanted to use.
I wish it was that precise. We would get a report back from...
I got texts all day long. And also we would meet as much... We had a war room in the center of campus with two 20-foot long whiteboards that kind of, you know, we kind of were keeping information shared amongst everybody. But again, things in this program move very quickly. And there were at least 3 to 4 to sometimes 10 different events happening at any
time. I think one way we've been thinking about it, or I think about it, is there was like plan A where it worked. And then there was the abyss where nothing worked. It was like a binary. And there was no, and because it's compressed too, there was no like shooting for 18 months to like do pickups, right? And
yeah, it's a 1 week event. Yes. It's like 52 weeks packed into 1 week.
Yeah.
Right. And either you get it or you don't. Yeah. I mean, that's, again, the risk here was pretty high.
But that's the wonderful thing about unscripted filmmaking is to be surprised. These kids surprised us. They surprised themselves. I think their trajectories through the program, which are successful, we won't spoil what happens, but we knew that they were great characters. We didn't know how well they would do. And there was one boy who we had met beforehand we liked, but he flamed out on day one. And
there's two.
Two, actually. Yeah.
Flamed out in what way?
They just didn't advance. Like, they just suddenly realized they couldn't cope. And actually, you see two of our characters who are main subjects, Stephen and Ben, both have difficulty and struggle that first day, but they sort of managed to overcome those challenges and survive.
Coming up after a break, McBain and Moss talk about why they decided to go to Sundance without a distributor. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Boy State, a new film from Jesse Moss and Amanda McBain, follows more than 1,000 teenage boys from across Texas as they compete for control of a mock legislature. After a year of editing reams of footage, Moss and McBain took the film to Sundance. Boy State had been financed by Concordia, the studio backed by Lorene Powell Jobs. Moss and McBain went to Sundance looking for a distributor, and they found one. The film sold to Apple and A24, for a reported $12 million, a record for a Sundance documentary. Were you literally in the condos or something waiting for the bids, or was it not like that?
It was like oddly like that thing you hear about, which has never been our experience as filmmakers, that there was an auction, we've never been the subject of an auction. And I think to go to Sundance, particularly now without distribution, it's become rarer and rarer. I think we've seen in the industry, and that's a risk, you know, a risk that we and our funder Concordia was willing to take. I think what that also allows you to do is really make the movie that you want to make with sort of without interference, I'll call it, you know, without regard for
a distributor telling you what to do. Yeah.
And I think really protecting that space. I mean, that's what Concordia was able to do for us so successfully. I mean, they gave us notes, but they were quick in giving us financing and very patient when we had to find our way through the edit. And in fact, we hoped we'd be at Sundance the year before, but we just weren't done. And we had to keep editing and finding our way through the film. And so we enlisted Josh Braun, who's a great sales agent, and to help us navigate the marketplace. And we had, you know, we feel extremely fortunate that we were able to premiere at Sundance in a theater, library theater with a 500 people. And that it was a magical experience to hear people laugh and to cry in the
room. Nobody had seen it.
Yeah, that's not common. Yeah.
I think that moment, you know, as it was energizing, I mean, but you never know. Like, we knew, we thought it was great. We liked our movie, you know, but you just don't know until you put it in front of an audience. And you know,
goodness, how thrilling was it to watch those bids roll in?
I mean, I think that premiere was definitely one of the like most exciting things I've ever experience.
But I think I was really, I think we were thinking less about the acquisition and more just about the experience. Yeah. And I mean, the highlight for me was Stephen.
His mom.
Stephen introducing his mother, who was in the audience. And you know, they actually, our team really kind of protected us from the dirty deal making. We went off and to celebrate the movie, and things were happening in the background. But they, you know, it wasn't like we were getting minute by minute updates. And I don't think they wanted us to be involved in that nitty gritty and to sort of see how, what would sift out, and who the suitors really were, who, you know, were in a position to really support this film.
And you chose Apple. You had bids, I think, from Netflix and Hulu. I mean, was there a particular strategy to that? Because I don't necessarily think that the margins were so different on the different offers from what I've heard. I mean, it is Lorraine Powell Jobs who financed it, so I don't know if that's a connection, but you tell me.
Not to our knowledge. I mean, I just think it was a competitive market, and we chose, I mean, the team really went with the partner we felt was in the strongest position to leverage this film out into the world.
And it was really an Apple A24 sort of...
Combo platter.
And, you know, we'd met with them and talked with them about, you know, how they felt about the film, what they thought about the film, what they thought they could do going forward. I mean, just, and that conversation was really resonant for us.
And it took a little while for that all to shake out. I mean, it was over that opening weekend. It wasn't like, I mean, I guess sometimes deals go down that night, but we didn't, I don't think anybody felt like we needed to rush. And we had a lot of other things to tend to with other screenings and chaperoning our young charges around. That's always a wild experience, I think, to suddenly find yourself, you know, on a big screen in a movie. So for them, that's what we were focused on. And it wasn't until Sunday that things wrapped up. And I don't know, it's really, we're still processing that. Amanda, I don't know what you would say about, I mean, it's, we're just sort of just through the launch of the film, and I mean, it's been a long lead up, and we've all had to adapt to this new world we're living in and pivoting from what had been planned, which was a theatrical followed by the streaming release to really just really more of a straight streaming release. But we accepted that fate pretty quickly, I think. And our partners were very adaptive, as they need to be, to what the world is.
Are there going to be some theaters, or is it simply not possible right now?
We did a drive-in event in 5 cities, which was great. We went to one in the drive-in in San Jose. And I think we're all hopeful that when there's theaters open up a bit more later in the fall, that we'll be able to still celebrate the film with audiences in person. We just pivoted to virtual conversations and screenings, which we had to do.
We're incredibly thankful. I mean, that Sundance of 2020 seems really like another century. but, you know, we're very thankful that we had that. And we're hoping for everybody going forward that we go back to that place.
We'd like to make a sequel called Girl State.
Yeah.
I mean, we're planning it. We think of it more as a sibling than a sequel, but I think it's a film that we think demands to be made, should be made.
Jesse Moss and Amanda McBain are the directors of Boys State, now streaming on Apple TV Plus. Thank you guys so much for doing this.
Thanks, Kim.
Thank you, Kim.
And that's The Business. Kevin Tidmarsh produced and edited today's program. Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.